Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano, who is in Charlottesville. How are things in Charlottesville?
Things in Charlottesville are great this morning, David. Thank you very much. It's actually, I know people care about the weather where I am. It's 70 degrees and sunny today. It's absolutely gorgeous.
Well, I think as some listeners know, I'm going to be joining you in the U.S. in April and the first bit of May, and I'm worried about melting because I think I've been acclimatized to Scotland too much. Right. February is Black History Month in the United States. And it started off with an inauspicious start in a way, because on February 1st, a news story broke about the governor of Virginia, Ralph Northam, where a picture emerged from his 1984 med school yearbook from the Eastern Virginia Medical School that depicts... It's a photo from his yearbook page that depicts two figures, one of whom is in a Ku Klux Klan robe or a facsimile of one, and the other person is a white person in blackface. This has caused all kinds of public outrage in the days since. There have been various calls for Northam's resignation. He initially apologized for appearing in the photo, but then subsequently backtracked and said it's actually not him in the photo, and he's not sure how that photo ended up on his yearbook page. But this is a ongoing story. But what we wanted to do is sort of talk about the history of blackface, what the sort of deep historical legacies of this kind of imagery is, and try to put it in some context.
Right, and I think a couple of things. That's an excellent summary, David. A couple of things bear thinking about as we go ahead. First of all, Northam is a Democrat, and the opposition, the calls for him to resign, have come mainly from members of his own party, as well as some Republicans who seem to be jumping on this as an opportunity, but yeah, I think Northam's partisan affiliation is interesting in this context, and we'll get into that. I suspect
there are very few people who are coming to his defense.
That's right. And another aspect of this, and we'll get into the details of Northam's actual responses. Well, there were a series of responses, but we'll get to that, I think. I won't say anything now. And the other thing I would say is, given that blackface as a kind of cultural practice in the United States, I mean, it actually has some European antecedents as well. It is mainly based in the antebellum period and extends through the Civil War and Reconstruction and into the 20th century. I mean, to some extent, I think we're in your area of expertise more than mine. So the appropriate way for us to structure at least the beginning of our conversation is for me to kind of yield the floor to you and ask you a few questions.
All right.
About this. So kind of a reverse of last week's episode on Brexit. This time I'll be the interviewer.
All right, and I'll pretend to know something. That's good.
Exactly. So David, can you tell us about the history of blackface as a kind of cultural practice in the United States? Where does it come from?
Well, so I mean, we have white people, Europeans, coloring their face to appear in theater, going back to Shakespeare. You can think about Othello or something. But this particular cultural practice of blackface dates to the late 1820s and really picks up steam thereafter. One of the originators of blackface minstrelsy, a particular theatrical mode, was a man named Thomas Rice, who developed a character called Jumping Jim Crow, or Jim Crow, or Daddy Jim Crow, depending on which version of the show he was doing, in which he would color his face either with burnt cork or with shoe polish, and put on a wig and wear ratty clothes and sing and dance what the audience was told were traditional African-American enslaved people's songs. But it was done as a sort of comedy, as a sort of a I don't want to say satirical, I'm not sure that's the right word, depiction of a mocking depiction of African Americans. So Rice sort of invents this genre, and then it gets picked up by all kinds of performers in the 1830s and 1840s. One of the more popular troupes of this was Dan Rice and his Virginia Minstrels, which performed in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. And this became, by the time you get to the Civil War, probably one of the most popular forms of entertainment in the United States, especially in the North. That is to say, a place where there are relatively few African Americans, and they are depicting this, enslaved culture as being in some ways only partially human. The characters are depicted in very much as stereotypes. The makeup that the actors are wearing overemphasizes the lips and the eyes in various ways. So it's very much creating a caricature of African American experience. There's lots of sort of cultural products from the 1850s that are still around with us today that actually have their origins in these minstrel shows. Stephen Foster, who was the most popular American composer in the mid-19th century, famous for songs like "Oh, Susanna," and "Old Folks at Home," those began as songs from minstrel shows. Songs like "Dixie," which of course becomes sort of the national anthem, if you will, for the Confederacy, began its life as part of a New York minstrel show. And one of the remarkable things about minstrelsy as a genre is that it has its origins here in the 1820s and 1830s, but then it carries on for much longer than a century, and it remains a very, very popular form of entertainment. It starts in the North, but then becomes a sort of national phenomenon after the Civil War. Arguably the most popular kind of American entertainment. And most of the actors are white performers who are putting on blackface. You also have a smaller number of African-American performers who also put on blackface. So they are black actors performing in this sort of stereotypical role. And there's actually a very interesting debate in the African-American community about the merits of this. Those in favor of it saying, look, if you are a black performer, this is the one way you actually get onto stage. The one black performer in Ziegfeld's Follies, for instance, was doing so in blackface. On the other hand, African-Americans from the very beginning point to this and saying, look, this is a racist stereotype that's being put on stage. Frederick Douglass was horrified at the popularity of minstrel shows. So it's a really pervasively, deeply racist kind of entertainment that, starts, during the Jacksonian period and then really continues well into the 20th century.
David, can I ask a couple of follow-up questions by way of clarification?
Yes.
One is, and I want to choose my words very carefully here, and I'm playing devil's advocate. In the 1820s, 30s, and 40s, we see the rise of kind of romantic nationalism on both sides of the Atlantic and a discovery of vernacular culture and a celebration of vernacular culture. So you see this in a lot of literature. You see this in kind of the writings of Walter Scott. You see it in, in Washington Irving's writings, for example, when he's discovering a kind of vernacular culture among the Dutch in New York, for example. And there's a kind of crude anthropology that's going on in popular culture and a kind of celebration of the vernacular. Could the rise of minstrel shows in this period be interpreted as part of that?
One could lump it in there. The difference is that Walter Scott, when he's creating this romantic version of what it is to be Scottish, is doing that as a Scottish person with the purpose of making both other Scottish people and people around the world admire Scotland and admire the virtues of Scottish people. And likewise, these other kind of ethno-nationalist tropes of the 19th century. Blackface is mostly created by white people to entertain white people by making fun of black people. It's part of a, it's growing out of a similar kind of racist and nationalist suppositions about the differences between people, but this is done at somebody's expense rather than as a means of glorifying or giving credit to a particular community.
I'm persuaded by that. I want to make that clear. But I do think it's of a piece with that kind of cultural turn in that period. I guess what's interesting is it persists in a way that other forms do not. I mean, you've done a good job of explaining the fact that it...
Thinking about its persistence, I mean, one of the things that's striking about it is, begins, in vaudeville, and it begins sort of in they used to have little minstrelsy bits between other, between acts of other shows. So if you went to go see Hamlet or something in New York in 1840, they would have had little, things in between the different acts to keep the audience busy or something, including those would be like little minstrelsy songs and things. So it was really designed as this sort of racist palate cleanser, if you will. But when you get into the 20th century, minstrelsy becomes very easily adapted to new media. And so you think about when they introduce film, some of the earliest depictions we have in film, the most popular depictions we have in film and historically significant films, feature blackface. So if we think about Griffith's Birth of a Nation from 1915. There are some black actors in that, but most of the black characters are played by white actors in blackface, and they are playing, if you watch that film, they are playing on many of the sort of tropes of minstrelsy, of blackface minstrelsy that go back a century earlier. If you look at Al Jolson's The Jazz Singer, the first talkie from 1927, I believe, the main character there, his performance in the second half of the movie is of him in blackface. And he is a blackface performer, and that's integral to the plot of that movie. The shift from stage to screen, it persists as an important trope. If you look at films from the 30s, 40s, and 50s, you have mainstream Hollywood actors performing in blackface. Like Judy Garland performed in blackface. There's all kinds of, people. Milton Berle performed in blackface. You have blackface on the radio, probably the most...
Amos and Andy.
That was the one I was thinking of, which was on for more than 30 years. And Amos and Andy is this radio show where the two main characters are African-American. Obviously, it's not blackface in a literal sense because it's radio and you can't see them. But there are two black characters who are sort of embodying these tropes, one of the tropes of blackface minstrelsy is that African Americans are simple-minded and foolish and what have you, and so they very much are playing with those tropes, and they're being played by white actors, or voiced by white actors, and so that's was a very really very powerful continuity in some ways of these ideas that start, more than a century earlier. Bugs Bunny has a bit in blackface. Have you ever seen Southern Fried Rabbit?
Yes, that's right.
From 1957, I believe, which is a
remarkably late, actually.
Well, it's this is right before the Civil War centennial, and it's got, if you're interested in ways in which Americans thought about the Civil War and race relations, during the Montgomery bus boycott and right before the Civil War centennial, watch Southern Fried Rabbit. It's it's Bugs Bunny, so it's.
Well, and if you look at, we're getting slightly off topic, but I think it's relevant. If you look at the early Tom and Jerry cartoons from the 40s, you know, there's a mammy character in those frequently, which is kind of a, well, it's a form of blackface, I guess. And it's been suggested that even Mickey Mouse, you know, the original Mickey Mouse character, Steamboat Willie, is a blackface character.
Mm.
You know, and particularly, well, his face is black and he's wearing white gloves, which is one of the characteristics of, you know, of an African-American butler.
Yeah. So actually, if you look at, you know, along those same lines, if you look at the depictions of both Aunt Jemima and Uncle Ben's, the syrup and the rice company, respectively, you know, those are both playing on blackface tropes. If you've actually, you can chart, if you watch their advertisements from the 30s and 40s to today, they get progressively less blackfacey in terms of their depictions of those two characters, but the oldest versions of them very much do play on these very racialized tropes that come from blackface.
So David, would you draw a distinction between appearing in blackface, which is to say minstrelsy, the kind of vaudeville tradition that you've described so well, and that persists for over a century? I mean, it's a really, really important cultural form. And I'm thinking about Hollywood now. Is there a distinction to be drawn between characters appearing in blackface on film, which is just a perpetuation of this racist stereotyping, as opposed to characters appearing as different races on film, which is problematic? I accept that it's problematic, but I'm thinking in this case of, you know, what could be called yellowface when you have, you know, Charlie Chan is not played by an Asian actor in the early 20th century, or, you know, I recently saw the film Touch of Evil, Orson Welles' film, which is a wonderful film. You know, Charlton Heston plays a Mexican character, arguably, I think he's got brown makeup on when he's doing that. More recently than that, Ben Kingsley played Gandhi. Would you draw a distinction between blackface and that kind of activity?
A subtle one, in as much, you know, you can think about John Wayne playing Genghis Khan or something.
Right. Is
that blackface was very much intended, you know, as a manifestation of racial power, right? It's about a white person making fun of a black person to an audience of white people by pretending to be black and behaving in buffoonish ways. And so it's a way of, you know, racial signaling of white superiority. You know, when we think about actors in the 1950s or even more recently, where they are playing a character of another race, I mean, I think they're doing that with a slightly different intent in most cases. But one thing I've seen, and I'm happy to see this, is that Hollywood has become progressively less willing to do that. I mean, we can think of the recent Lone Ranger movie that had Johnny Depp as what's Tonto? Is that the Lone Ranger?
Yeah, that's right.
And I think he was widely criticized for that. You know, likewise, there was some criticism of the Doctor Strange movie that had Tilda Swinton as the Ancient One, even though the Ancient One, they changed the gender of that character too. So there's, generally of the opinion and that, you know, when you cast a character, you know, cast an actor, you should do one that sort of represents the population they're trying to enact to the extent that you can. And I think Hollywood is increasingly paying more attention to that, recognizing that it's, you know, the problematic nature of you know, casting a person who is able-bodied to play a disabled character, for instance, or what have you. But I think it's they're related phenomena, but not necessarily identical.
So you would, I mean, the key distinction you're drawing seems to be about intent and what the intention of the portrayal is.
I think so. I think, you know, both are unacceptable in a 2019 context. The question of what was acceptable in a 1984 context when Northam had his yearbook is maybe a slightly different discussion.
Well, and I asked that question because I think I'm setting up for our return to when we get back to Ralph Northam in a few minutes here, because I think he conceded that he did appear in blackface, but in a different context. But we'll get to that. We'll get to that in a second. And so I think there may be a distinction to be drawn, but I'm not sure. Let me. And again, I'm doing this because I'm your foil in this episode. Is it always wrong to appear in blackface?
In 2019, yes, I would say that there's, you know, one of the you'll see news stories every year, or there have been news stories every year of
Halloween,
on Halloween especially, but also on other occasions of usually it's sort of for fraternity boys or some other kind of nonsense. Sorry, I didn't mean to insult fraternity boys. Maybe I did. I don't really care. Who put on blackface in the context of Halloween or in context of some skit or some context of whatever. And, you know, when they get called out on it, their justification is, I'm not a racist. I wasn't intending to enact racism by putting on blackface. I was just doing it for a bit of fun. Can't you take a joke? Is usually their defense. And ultimately, I don't, in that case, I don't think their intent matters. I think their ignorance of what that means is actually, you know, sort of what's telling. Because whether they know it or not, they are participating in this very lengthy tradition of white people using blackface as a means of, you know, it's a very subtle means of racial oppression, but it falls in line with that. It's not an accident, I think, or it's not inconsequential that the character that Thomas Rice created for blackface, that sort of the origin of blackface minstrelsy, Jim Crow, that character becomes the name given, you know, in the late 19th century and well throughout the middle of the 20th century to define term for racial segregation in the American South, so that, you know, there's a clear, you know, it made sense when people were talking about what kind of system are we creating where we are distinguishing between white people and black people. We're going to name it after a blackface character, a character that a white person created to make fun of African Americans at their expense, and to minimize their humanity and to signal that they are different. And I think it's, you know, for African Americans to see white people in blackface, especially white people who are in positions of authority, or in some cases like Northam's case later in positions of authority, I think that is, you know, they read that as a racist intention, even if, you know, who knows what's in these kids' head when they're making the choice to do this.
Would you say the same about dressing in yellow face, red face, or brown face?
I think anytime, like it's for Halloween, like anytime you're dressing up as anytime you're dressing up as any kind of ethnicity, that's just a mistake. You know, they got so many other choices about things you can dress up as. You know, the costume store has got every superhero you want to be. You know, if you want to dress up like Michael Jackson, and this is what Northam claimed he was doing for this dance competition where he actually admitted to putting on blackface, you put on a sparkly glove and a jacket and you're Michael Jackson. You don't need to, you know, use blackface to do that. I don't personally ever see a reason for justification for it. What are your thoughts on the?
Well, I would agree with you. I think it's first of all, I hate Halloween anyway. I think it's stupid, but that's another discussion. But I think
I can't let that sit. You hate Halloween?
I think Halloween's stupid.
Kind of monster are you? Okay.
I am a monster. I am a monster. And I didn't even like it that much when I was a kid. But that's I just think it's silly. I think adults dressing up for Halloween is a bizarre. I mean, if you're going to a Halloween party, that's one thing. But now adults dress up to take their kids trick-or-treating, which just seems bizarre to me. Anyway.
You have no sense of fun, Frank.
I have a sense of fun. I am a fun guy. Anyway, I don't like being told by Big Candy when I have to have fun. That's me.
Okay.
Anyway.
Big Candy, great.
But I don't think
you just lost us a sponsorship, Frank. That's great.
I don't think it's a good idea for people dress up as other races and ethnicities, because particularly if you happen to be a member of a group that has political, social, and cultural power. So I'm thinking about white males in particular, but in the context of the United States, whites dress up like other races. I just don't think it's probably not a good idea for anybody to do so.
And on Thanksgiving, don't dress up like Indians. Like, don't do that.
No, that's right, and so,
which was a thing until fairly recently.
Yes, and school pageants and all this kind of thing. But I feel like a bit of a scold in saying that, but I just don't think it's a very good idea.
I don't think you need to be a scold for saying, like, don't be racist, kids. I mean, I think
it should be self-evident to us. This should be one of Jefferson's self-evident truths in 2019, but apparently it's not.
No, it wasn't self-evident to him either. But
No, indeed. I would agree with you, David. I just don't think it's a very good idea. I do think that people sometimes do so. This is really giving people the benefit of the doubt. Without malice, and don't understand the history. And it's because of the history of this that it's particularly insidious, dangerous, and frankly offensive. And I think in some cases people do know that and they pretend they don't. I think in other cases, people, especially in other kind of national and cultural contexts, people may do it not quite realizing just how offensive it is. Well,
just as a follow-up on that, one of the things that happens with minstrelsy shows is they start in the United States, but then they really then get exported to the rest of the world. And they have continued in other parts of the world long after for the most part, minstrelsy as a popular medium died out. I don't know, it's 1960 or something. Minstrelsy, as in various forms, is still around in Japan. In the UK, there were minstrelsy on TV into the 70s. There were children's toys, and I wasn't familiar with these until I moved here. The Gollywogs. Which use sort of images from minstrelsy. They're these little dolls of African. They're African American dolls, or they're black dolls, but they have the similar kinds of imagery that I think is drawn at least in part from minstrelsy. They're very deeply racist, but were very much a part of, part of British culture. Until very recently. I've had students say they played with them as children.
And I've seen kind of that kind of imagery in Scandinavia, for example, where, of course, I mean, in Britain, it's problematic because people really should know better given Britain's own history of race and slavery. But even in places in kind of continental Europe, one sees some of this where it's slightly surprising. Now, I'm not saying it's acceptable, but I'm saying, and I think you're right, I think it's testimony to how pervasive this culture was for such a long time.
Yeah. Well, with the Gollywogs, there was an interesting story, a local Edinburgh story. We've got a museum in town called the Museum of Childhood that's about basically children's toys and children's stuff going back for several centuries. And its primary target audience in some ways is children who are interested in, let's go see what kids used to play with. And they have a huge collection of these Gollywog dolls, which are simultaneously, things kids played with. So it's appropriate that a museum to the history of childhood has them. On the other hand, they're really, really racist. So do you want to put them on display to be shown to children? And you know, they've had debates about how best to articulate, display those for that setting, that audience. I mean, all of which I think says that there's, you know, this very old, you know, art form, if that you want to call it that, or that has some very deep resonances today. And I think that's part of why people responded to images of Northam from his yearbook the way they did. We may want to actually explain what a yearbook is, because I realized that yearbooks aren't as much of a thing here in the UK. I found an article from The Guardian from 2010 that says, hey, British people, well, there's this new American thing that's showing up called yearbooks. Let us explain to you what it is. And I just looked at my younger son's yearbook from he just finished high school. And it's sort of a pale imitation of an American yearbook. So do you want to explain, Frank, to British audiences who aren't familiar with what exactly a yearbook is, what this whole the idea behind a yearbook and a yearbook page is?
Well, it goes back to, I mean, one of the big cultural differences between Britain and the U.S. is the affinity and affiliation that Americans feel for the institutions they studied at, whether it be high school and or college or university. And so there's a kind of intense alumni association that alumni often have, not always, with their old school. Now, British people have this as well, but not to the. It's just a different kind of cultural manifestation. And part of this is that people identify strongly with the class they graduated with, the class of 87 or the class of 2019 or what have you. And each year, the class will, particularly the graduating class, will produce a book that's a record of that class's achievements. And normally, well, it depends on the institution, but often people will have a in that yearbook. So it's a book that's produced over the course of the final year of study that is a kind of artifact, a souvenir of your time in the school.
Yeah, these are big, thick books, right? So these are
they're books.
They're like A4 size, and they're usually several hundred pages.
And they're glossy, and you know, they look like they're bound. They look like magazines, but they're bound like books, and yeah. they're very substantial. And the tradition of producing these goes back at least a century, I think, in colleges and high schools.
Yeah, they start to become very prominent in the 1890s. There's some sort of antecedents to it, but really about the technology for reproducing photos and whatnot, you know, made them sort of more ubiquitous starting more than a century ago.
What's interesting to me, David, is when Northam was giving his comment, and he kept talking about his page and the book, it was hard not to think of Facebook, and I wonder if your book from the UK are starting to, because I wonder if their day might not have passed, because we have different ways electronically and digitally and on social media to both stay connected with our classmates, but also to kind of commemorate that our period of study. So to some extent,
has been a decline in the publication of yearbooks over the past 10 years. And I think most people have pointed to the internet and Facebook and whatnot as the reason for that.
Northam's generation, he's slightly older than I am, which is to say much older than you, but the 80s and 90s might have been the heyday of the yearbook in many respects. And when you get your yearbook, when you got your yearbook at the end of the year, it was always a big deal, and your friends would sign it and write, you know, how much they'd never forget you and all that sort of thing in it. And having a yearbook, my wife still has our yearbooks from my wife came as a visiting student to go to high school in America from Sweden as a teenager, and loved this concept because it was totally unknown in Sweden at the time, and you know, still, you know, she said, oh, you know, she'll say, do you want to look at our yearbooks? And I usually say no, but because I hate fun, as you know. So they really are an artifact. I mean, while they've been produced for over a century, I really think it's interesting that both Brett Kavanaugh and Ralph Northam seem to have got into trouble for yearbooks produced in the 1980s, and we might get back to that in a second. But the yearbook is a kind of important cultural artifact of long standing, which, as I said, may be past its heyday, not least because it's becoming quite apparent that if you want to have a career later in life, you have to be very careful about what you put in your yearbook as a teenager.
So if I were to ask your wife, what does it say on your yearbook page, would she know?
She probably would. Yes, I'm sure she would.
Did you have a quotation on your yearbook page?
I'm not discussing any of this. Although I will say the following. I was active in a lot. Sorry, this is gonna. I don't know how to say this. All right. We might want to edit this out, David. But I was pretty active in a lot of areas in high school, and yes, none of that was reflected in my yearbook statement. I left it all out.
Okay.
Well, which was a kind of. I now look in retrospect, probably humble bragging.
Ah, so people will know you. They don't need to have your CV replicated for them.
So it might not, which is one of the things you do, and you have a quote and everything else. But it's there's very little of me in the yearbook. I was a yearbook editor, which is a big deal, as you know.
Oh.
And so I went deliberately low key.
So as it reflects the Northam case, he claims that the first time he saw this yearbook page was on the 1st of February, so just a few days ago, which isn't the way that most yearbooks work, but they may have had a different arrangement at Eastern Virginia Medical School in 1984 than they did at most high schools. I think most people were surprised that med schools had a yearbook, because that strikes us as a middle school, high school.
Yeah, it kind of stops with college, I think. Not undergraduate. Most people don't have a graduate school yearbook, I think. I mean, I want to choose my words carefully here. I was going to say, in Northam's defense, I found that part of his explanation credible. So he said, I never saw this before. And a lot of people said, oh, sure, you must have. But the difference, I think that distinction is important. I think because it was a medical school yearbook, a professional school, a graduate school, it's entirely possible. I mean, he seemed genuine when he claimed to be genuinely surprised by this.
That's the one part of the story that seemed at least potentially plausible to me as well.
Particularly because he was in the Army at the time. So he went to medical school when he was in the Army and then presumably was deployed. It seems to me like he never saw that yearbook.
That seems plausible.
Unlike high school or even college, when you might really kind of labor over what's on your yearbook page, he may not have done so. Let me back up and just go through the sequence of events over the weekend, because that might help. Mm. So if that's okay.
Sure.
So Northam was contacted, I think, last Friday on the 1st of February, and confronted with this horrible image from his yearbook page. He issued an apology immediately, which kind of flies in the face of what politicians sometimes do, but he tried to get out in front of it and seemed to admit accept responsibility for it. And the implication was, and there was a terrible chyron on CNN that said, you know, Virginia governor doesn't know whether he's in blackface or KKK hood. That's not a kind of place you want to be. But he kind of took responsibility for it with a written statement on Friday night. That didn't seem to satisfy people. And so he then issued a kind of awkward video apology late on Friday. Then on Saturday in the middle of the afternoon, he held a press conference. And in the press conference, he gave a fairly lengthy statement. It was 20 minutes or so, I think. I watched it, kind of acknowledging the offensiveness of the photograph, but actually saying, that's not me in the photograph. I am neither of those individuals, and I've kind of gone back to check this. I don't know who's in the photograph, but it's not me. And I was not at a party like that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of people said, oh, come on, you're kidding. But his explanation was, look, I never saw that yearbook page. I didn't approve that yearbook page. And it's entirely possible that the editors of the yearbook put the wrong picture on my page. And that's that. You know, an error was made. Having edited a yearbook myself, I can concede that that's entirely possible. And given that the two individuals in the photo, one is wearing a hood, the other's in blackface, they may not have known, they may have misidentified the figures in that photo and put it on Ralph Northam's page in error. So that's his claim. There's a slight problem with this, or there are two problems. So I find that a plausible explanation. Two things came out, however, over the weekend that are key additional pieces of information. It was revealed that in his high school yearbook, North at Virginia Military Institute, which is an all-male school.
No, it's college.
Undergraduate, yes, sorry, apologies. Northam, you know, one of his nicknames, because you sometimes put your nicknames under your real name in a yearbook, was Coon Man, which is undoubtedly an offensive reference to African Americans. And he didn't really have a good explanation for that. And secondly, he conceded in his press conference on Saturday that he did appear in blackface when he was in a dance competition in San Antonio, Texas in 1984, and he was appearing as Michael Jackson. And so, as you said, he had the costume on, but he also, as he put it, put a little bit of shoe polish on his face. He said it wasn't that much because it's difficult to get off, which didn't seem very credible. To give him the benefit of the doubt, one could argue that this was more like actors playing roles of different races. We may or may not find that credible or not. I'm just saying that would be the most charitable interpretation of that activity that one could come up with. But Northam said, I am neither of the people in that picture. However, I did do this. I did it unthinkingly. He was pretty thoughtful about it. He explained that when he was on the campaign trail running for governor of Virginia in 2017, he spoke to one of his aides who was black, and the aide explained to him why that was unacceptable, and he acknowledged that it was unacceptable, and he didn't seek to defend that behavior. The point being that in that era, he did appear in blackface, so one can make of that what they will, and indeed the Democratic Party has decided that he needs to go as a result of this. His explanation about the yearbook page actually makes sense to me, because it was a medical school page and because he was in the army. I think he may not have seen it, and it could have been put on his page in error. Now, what it says about the culture of that school, that appeared on the page,
it's
more telling.
Yeah, thinking about there appear to be other images from that yearbook that are of people in blackface or other things that are racially questionable. Or just outright racist in that yearbook. Do you know what the name of the University of Virginia's yearbook was for more than a century?
I do not.
It was called Corks and Curls. And there's various explanations for why in 1888 they decided to name the yearbook this. But the most popular explanation is that cork is what you use to blacken your face. You use cork and you burn it, and it blackens your face. And so it's actually named after the minstrelsy shows, and minstrelsy was a very popular student activity at the University of Virginia for a very long period of time. And so from 1888 until 2008, when it folded, that the name of the yearbook at the University of Virginia may have had ties to minstrelsy, which I think is horrifying in all kinds of ways.
Sorry, go ahead, David.
No, you had a thought. Go with it.
Well, I was going to say it's very interesting to me that we've had a lot of focus on yearbooks in the recent news cycles because Brett Kavanaugh's high school yearbook came up and some of the references there. Yes. And I think we have where there's an interesting question that this raises for me, which is the degree to which should be held accountable for what they did at a relatively young age. Now, it should be said, Brett Kavanaugh was a 17-year-old in high school, I think, when the material was extracted from his yearbook, or the time period that it focuses on. Ralph Northam was in his mid-20s when his medical school yearbook was produced, so he was an adult. So I may not, we might set the Northam case aside for a moment, but I think this also applies to social media today. Because if anything, we're going to have more embarrassing stuff about candidates going forward because younger people have had their entire lives recorded, sometimes without their consent by their parents, but certainly when they're adolescents and at university. And I think we need to decide what to do with this earlier information. Now, in some cases, I think for misdemeanors, I think we need to just give people a pass. I think for more serious matters and where we draw that line is an interesting thing to discuss. I think racism is more than a misdemeanor, but I think this raises an interesting question. I think there will be embarrassing. I assume that everybody running for president in 2020 is now looking at every single yearbook they might appear in right now. But I think for younger people going forward, this is also a question.
Yes, I think it is. I mean, one of the things I think about the, you know, a yearbook or other kinds of media like this, that you, the supposition that you have when you're making it is the only people looking at it will be your classmates and maybe your teachers and, you know, maybe a parent or two, right? You think of it as a hermetically sealed document in terms of who's going to access it. You don't expect that people are going to be picking through things from 35, 40 years ago. I mean, I think with the generation of young people today, one of the things I've noticed is a lot of them are actually very, very careful about what they put on social media, in part because they know that all this material will last forever. And so I think there are lots of young people who are very circumscribed about what it is that they post on Facebook and Twitter and other things. And what other social media sites are out there that they use that I'm not aware of because I'm old. You know, and I think we'll end up with a point where there are certain kinds of things that used to be embarrassing and disqualifying a generation ago will a generation from now not be disqualifying. You know, there's lots of public shaming about, you know, naked pictures or whatever. 5-10 years ago, there's less today, and I think there'll probably less some in 10 or 20 years. But other kinds of things like explicitly racist behavior, I think, will continue to be, you know, held up for scorn as it should be.
Yeah. So, David, one of the things that struck me about the Northam case is the fact that most major Democrats called on him to resign almost immediately. I mean, there was calls for his resignation started on Friday evening and continued all the way through Saturday and into Sunday. And his press conference didn't seem to change, move the needle in the other direction at all. He hasn't yet resigned, it must be said. And I think there's an interesting contrast there between the way Republicans have responded to similar embarrassing information in recent months. So I'm thinking there's a photograph of Mitch McConnell has been going around on Twitter in front of a Confederate flag. Steve King, the congressman from Iowa, was recently given a slap on the wrist by the Republicans for his association with white supremacy and neo-Nazi groups in Europe. But really, nobody's called on him to resign for that, and it's much more egregious than what Northam is accused of. So I think the two parties have taken slightly different views on this, although lots of Republicans have called on Northam to resign, of course.
Yes.
But the main reason for this is, of course, they've been forced to defend President Trump's statements and actions, and so they don't feel that they can ask anybody to resign, I suppose. But one of the interesting things, and maybe this is a note we could end on, that struck me is in Republican condemnation of Northam, there's been a lot of activity on social media and elsewhere where Republicans have cited the trope, and this is really an important one to them, that the Democrats were historically the party of slavery and white supremacy. And we've talked about the history of the Democratic Party on this question in an earlier pod, but that's come up a lot. And they've been sort of saying, see, we're the party of Lincoln. They're the party of racism and white supremacy, not us. And that's come up a lot in the past few days in terms of right-wing criticism of Northam. Do you have any response to that?
Well, you know, sometimes what they're saying is true in as much as, you know, they make these claims that, oh, you know, everyone who was voting for emancipation were Republicans, you know, everyone who founded the Klan was a Democrat. Yeah, that's true. But the racial politics, the Republican Party, the Democratic Party in the 1860s is not the same as those two parties in the 1960s, and it sure as hell isn't the same as those parties in 2019. The linear relationship, the familial relationship between the Republican Party today and the Party of Lincoln is pretty attenuated, and so I think it's sort of cherry picking certain moment. You know, if the high point on terms of racial politics that your party has is a century and a half ago, that's pretty depressing. So I think that's, you know, misreading what happened to try to sort of claim a sort of a legacy that they don't really deserve.
Well, even it's not even a century and a half ago, because I think it was last night that Sean Hannity, you know, proclaimed, you know, he reminded his viewers that more than 100 Democrats voted against the Civil Rights Act. But of course, it's a very different Democratic Party, right? even 60 years, 50 or 60 years ago.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I think, you know, the political realignment that happened in the, you know, 30 years between the end of the Second World War and Watergate is so profound that, you know, I think, you know, the names of the two parties remain the same, but very little else survived that transformation, especially with regards to racial politics. So, you know, I think it's a sort of a amnesia of everything that's happened, especially over the past 40 years. Sort of one final point on the Sol Northam case before we sort of wrap up, you know, that is worth mentioning is, of course, that this is happening at a medical school and a predominantly white medical school in Virginia. And it's worth pointing out the very long and problematic history of medical schools and the medical profession with regards to African Americans, you know, going back centuries, that this sort of evokes. You know, I'm thinking here of J. Marion Sims, the quote-unquote father of gynecology, who performed experimental surgery on enslaved people without using anesthesia, although he could have, because he saw that saw enslaved people as being both more tolerant to pain and, you know, perfectly acceptable guinea pigs for his experiments. You know, I'm thinking here about Dania Barry's wonderful book, The Price for Their Pound of Flesh, which talks extensively about the ways in which American medical schools, including ones in Virginia, used, you know, the bodies of enslaved people, both when they are dead and when they are alive, for students to experiment on and to practice with. And, you know, I see more recently things like Henrietta Lacks, you know, a poor African-American woman whose body was exploited by science because of its, you know, particular attributes to their benefit and not to hers. And so there's a very long, complicated history of medical institutions and medical schools in particular with regards to their racial politics that I think this sort of touches upon. When Northam is doing this in 1984, are we using modern, you know, 2019 standards and projecting them back into 1984?
I don't think so. I mean, as I said, I'm younger than Ralph Northam, but not a whole lot younger. So I was in high school then, or I had just graduated. I was in college. But I was a yearbook editor the year before that. We would not have put that in a yearbook. I mean, people were not routine. You know, I was, you know, in college in the 1980s, and nobody dressed up in blackface and went to a party.
No,
to my knowledge, and the reason they didn't was you knew it was wrong. So yeah. I think in some cases we can apply the standards retrospectively, but in this case it was wrong then.
Oh yeah, I came to the same conclusion. There was a movie that came out, and I think this is sort of telling, called Soul Man, that came out in 1986. Did you see that?
I did not see it.
It was not a good movie. It was about a white character who wanted to go to law school but didn't have any money for it. So he took a bunch of tanning pills to become black. I don't know whether you can actually do this. And got a scholarship intended for African Americans, and then goes to law school and experiences discrimination because people think he's black or something. It was not a particularly good movie, although it was trying very hard to be progressive on racial questions, even if it is in some ways still using blackface kinds of tropes by using a white actor and darkening his skin. But the NAACP rightly criticized it and says, like, this is totally unacceptable, you know, regardless of what your intent is, you know, putting blackface on, has this very troubled history, and even if you mean well by it, it's not kosher. I think that movie came out right at the same time that this photo, this yearbook comes from. So, you know, I think one does not put on blackface, and one sure as hell doesn't put on a Klan uniform, right? So it's not just the blackface, it's the blackface and the Klan uniform in juxtaposition to each other. You know, now he says on his yearbook pages that he really enjoys beer, which seems to be the common thread connecting yearbook pages and Republican politician or actually a Republican Supreme Court member and Democratic governor in the Chesapeake region. Their affinity for beer seems to be causing part of their problem. What do you think should happen to Northam?
Well, I think he should resign. And I think he should probably do it sooner rather than later. But he does seem determined to stay. So it's an interesting question how long he will resist the pressure from his party. Interestingly, I mean, I've been a Virginia voter for all of 3 months now. So as you can imagine, I really have a fine-grained understanding of the politics here in the Commonwealth. But I have been speaking to people here about this, and their shock and disappointment is pretty palpable. And these are people who, in many cases, voted for Northam, but they feel that, you know, he's got to go. And as much as that's an indicator, I think he's got to go. Whether he will or not, I don't know. And there's all kinds of paradoxes here, or interesting ironies here, because the lieutenant governor is a man named Justin Fairfax, who's African American. He recently achieved some a great deal of press coverage, laudatory press coverage, because he sat out the state's official commemoration of Robert E. Lee Day, because as the one state African American statewide official, he felt he could not and would not attend the ceremony to honor Robert E. Lee. And so Justin Fairfax would be in line to succeed Northam if Northam resigns. Virginia has kind of real term limits for its governors, but Fairfax could then run for re-election in 2020, and he'd be possibly set up to do so.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that there's – you can only be elected to one term, I guess, as governor. The governor in Virginia, compared to some other states, has some real power in terms of his sort of legislative authority. People have talked about impeachment, but this doesn't actually seem to qualify for impeachment, because it's not high crimes and misdemeanors. It's phenomenally bad judgment, you know, 30 years ago.
Yeah,
but it doesn't seem to actually fit the standard that the Virginia Constitution lays out for an impeachable offense. One rationale I've heard is if he wants to stake it out, he's entirely within his power to do that, and there's very little that his critics can do to rein him in if that's what he wants to do with the next few years of his life.
Right. Well,
we will see what happens as this unfolds. What's your last drop, Frank?
I actually have two, David. One is I would like to remind people about Joanne Freeman's upcoming Fennell lecture at the University of Edinburgh. Joanne will be talking about her book Field of Blood, about violence in Congress in the antebellum period, and the lecture is on March 21st. We've recently moved to a larger venue. We're going to be in the Playfair Library, which is actually probably the nicest public room at the university, so it's going to be a wonderful occasion. So please go on. You can Google it. We'll put it on the page, our show page, but please, if you haven't got your tickets yet, there are more available now. Please do so. The other thing I want to – sorry, David, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say if you tried to get a ticket earlier and you were unsuccessful because it was sold out for a while, now it's in a bigger venue, there are new tickets available. So
that's right.
Persistence pays off.
Yes. My second one I would like to observe is that the New England Patriots played in the Super Bowl the other night.
I heard about this. There was a game or something. Yes.
Yeah. There was a sporting contest in Atlanta. there was a moment that attracted a little attention. There was a moment during the game when Tom Brady, the Patriots quarterback, was heard. He was calling an audible play, and he said, "Reagan, Reagan," and then the play went right. And the commentator, I think, was Tony Romo, said, "Well, clearly Reagan means go to the right." And obviously, that wasn't presumably a code they could use again. But I thought that was very amusing, and it did lead me to wonder about possible alternatives. So if he'd said Nixon, Nixon, would you kind of fake to the right but actually be closer to the center than you think, but still cheat, which would kind of be in keeping with the Patriots ethos? If you go
Bravo.
Bernie. Is Bernie going far to the left? And so it's got all kinds of potential.
Yeah,
Anyway.
okay, we'll have to have a whole playbook of American political history. Okay, good.
So, David, what's your last drop?
Well, so I want to have a follow-up to last week. Last week's I mentioned that Bennett College, a college for African American women, historically a black college for African American women in Greensboro, North Carolina, was in danger of losing its accreditation in large part because it had financial difficulties. And I mentioned last week that there was a fundraising effort to try to save this one of two black women's colleges in the country. And I'm very happy to report that at least as of this morning, they had surpassed their goals. The goal I think they had was for $5 million, and I think they've raised something in the order of $7.5 million at this point. Hopefully they'll get more soon, and hopefully that will save Bennett College. So for those of you listening who donated money, thank you. The second thing I want to have is SASA, the Scottish Association for the Study of America, is having their annual conference on the 2nd of March, and registration is now open. So if you are in the greater Edinburgh area and want to hear some American history and American studies, please come to SASA. It's open to anybody who is interested, and I'll put registration information on the show page and on Twitter. And we're also having on Friday a one-day postgraduate training day. And if you are a postgraduate student anywhere within or who managed to get to Edinburgh that Friday, and you want to come and learn about publishing, you want to learn about how to get grants, you want to learn about the job market, you want to learn about how to network in American studies and American history. We're having a day-long workshop on that, and that's open to any postgraduate student who's interested. So please come to SAS. It should be a good time. It's their 20th anniversary, so it should be extra special.
Excellent.
All right. Till next time, Frank.
Cheers, David.
Cheers.
Bye.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.